Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about the ancient world, TV shows about the ancient world. This week, we're talking about Troy for some reason. I am Milo Edwards, and I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host Phoebe Roy and Patrick Wyman. How are we doing?
Hi, hi.
Hello. Living the dream, another day in paradise, somewhere in between those two extremes, I am to be found.
Yeah, if you've got a graph tracking Patrick's mental state based on the intros, you can log both living the dream and another day in paradise there.
Precisely where those belong on the x-axis of life is hard to say.
Sending the cops to do a wellness check on Dr.
if you hear a man of a certain age say, if a man of a certain age is asked how he's doing and he replies another day in paradise, really and seriously do the wellness check. Like that's the time for it. Because he's not okay. Is nobody says another day in paradise and things are going well. That's those things are mutually exclusive.
I saw an Australian comedian show and he was talking about, I think it was like getting fired from a TV job or something, or like not getting paid for a TV job. And apparently he was like, yeah, on the call, I got a bit crazy. And I was just like, I may as well just fucking kill myself. And then he said, they sent the cops to do a wellness check on me and they turned up 3 days later. He was like, the cops were like, let's see where he goes with this. Checking if he's serious for 3 days.
Yeah. Look, you know, at least they got there. Cops in the US probably would have shown up and then shot your dog after 3 days.
Mm. Well, those cops in the US turn up to make sure you did it. They're like, we're going to finish the job.
Hey, look, that's what our tax dollars pay for in this country, baby.
Mm. Beautiful.
Finishing the job. So to speak.
Finishing the job. We don't start a job, but we do finish it.
That's true. Yeah.
The only universal healthcare the US has is assisted dying. And all you have to do is just call the cops to your own house and wait.
Oh, buddy, in the United States, you've got so many options. Like, why pick the cops? You could step onto a not especially busy road. You could ride your bike somewhere. You could simply breathe the air in large swaths of the United States, and that's going to be enough to do it. So
walk into someone's garden in Florida, wait for nature to take its course.
You don't even have to go onto someone's private property. You can say something to the wrong person at a convenience store and you'll be on your way to the pearly gates.
I like that you said let nature take its course. Like your average Florida gunman is a kind of forest creature.
They are. They're sylvan sprites.
Whom you must not startle.
You mustn't startle them.
Yeah. So the retired sylvan sprites of the Everglades. Yes. That's
this is why we go out to the Everglades. We have our binoculars. We're sitting in the little wood cabin being like, oh, I see one. Mm-hmm. Look at it. Look.
That's Gerald. Gerald is a retired HR professional from Mankato, Minnesota, who's moved to Florida mostly for the guns and the shooting.
And there's Arlene, that's his wife. You know, they mate for life.
Yeah, they do. Not happily, but they do mate for life.
Not happily, but they do. But they do mate for life. And look, you can see. Look. There's one. There's a little one. You can tell because they don't have an assault rifle. They just have a little gun.
Yeah. If you want to see a Florida man, you just leave out a little dish of meth.
Pocket pistol.
Because they like that.
This is entirely too accurate, by the way. There's you could be describing life in, or you could be describing a I'm not going to call it a birding expedition, a retiring expedition, I suppose. I'm not sure what the precise terminology is, but you get the idea.
Old birding.
Oh yeah.
That's excellent. Yeah.
Just don't call Florida man a sack of wine or you'll be in big trouble.
No. They only do boxes of wine there.
There's a sack in the box though.
There is. It's a kind of
womb of wine that they have.
The goon bag.
Within the box.
This I did I haven't thought about this in the better part of 20 years, but I do recall being at a party where they had taken the bag out of a box of wine and were just holding it above your head and opening the spigot. And Beautiful. Then they would slap the bag to really get a nice rush out of it. And I just remember this youthful hooligan, who I'm sure is now a captain of industry in some field, screaming, "Slap the bag" at me at the top of his lungs over and over and over again.
Always good advice. Always good advice.
Yeah. I literally have not thought about this moment in 20 years, but I promise you it did happen.
Well, I'm obsessed with the bit in the movie Troy where he goes, "You sack of wine," which is actually kind of a direct translation from the Iliad, but it sounds so insane in English. And I was referring to this to an Australian pal and she went, "Oh, like a goon bag." And I'm like, I don't think that's what Achilles had in mind. But I love the idea of them having a sort of Aussie barbecue music festival type vibe in the Greek camp at Troy. And they're just they're
Achilles,
playing like goon
sack
roulette.
The Australian gap here.
they've got a goon bag hooked up to a rudimentary washing line and they're spinning it round, you know.
You would have loved working illegally in a bar in Sydney.
Oh, wouldn't he just?
I mean, really, Patroclus really got lost on the way to Bondi Beach, is my understanding.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they dipped him in cocaine up to his heel.
Oh, God. So I'm assuming we have all seen this movie before at various points in the past. Did anything stand out to you guys on the rewatch that didn't really occur to you before, now that we are effectively professional taker-aparters of media about the ancient world?
So when this film came out, I was an age, because it was a period of time ago, which we will not discuss in any detail because, you know, we're only historians. We don't care when things happened.
What's a decade here or there?
What's a decade? Yeah, exactly. Like, if you're an ancient historian, a decade is like, that's like a pussy time measurement. Like, who gives a shit about a decade?
It's like how the old, until fairly recently, you couldn't get a degree in history after that covered a period after 1914 at Oxford and Cambridge because it was considered journalism. That was
look, well, we're working in centuries, baby. I don't recognize a decade.
Correct.
Well, Pat, you know that I mentioned this on an episode recently, but my director of studies at Cambridge, because of his interest in Byzantine history, was awarded by Oxford a PhD in modern history.
And this is correct.
He was like, Oxford. Yeah.
This is correct. Byzantine history is modern history. A decade. It is. A decade is a bitch unit.
It's true.
That's what I think.
This is increasingly clear to me after doing archaeology and the more distant past, much of which we'll discuss today as we go over the kind of late Bronze Age in the Aegean. Like, if you can get it within 50 years, you're doing great.
Yeah.
That's if you are within 50 years of a time measurement, like, so when you do the new thing in archaeology is to do kind of weighted distributions of radiocarbon dates from an archaeological site. So instead of getting one sample or two samples, you try to get like 20 samples. And then because the radiocarbon dating method is a probabilistic one, if you just stack up more measurements, you can get a tighter time window. So This is now how this works. But even with the probabilistic measuring, it's called a Bayesian approach to radiocarbon dating. You still are working in like 20 to 50 year chunks. You could have like 50 dates and you're still trying to get within like 40 or 50 years. That's the best case scenario here.
Yeah.
So there's today's lesson on Bayesian radiocarbon dating.
Is it?
We need a jingle for that.
I realized I didn't have a real strong conclusion to that. I just had Bayesian radiocarbon dating on the brain, and I was searching for a segue.
Bayesian dating in the morning.
Bayesian dating is like a really, really statistical approach to Hinge.
It's a new show on Netflix. It runs right after Love is Blind.
It's a numbers game. That's what they say.
It's, you know, have you ever wondered what the statistical basis for the idea of keeping a lot of irons in the fire is? Well,
buddy,
we got you covered.
Might you be interested in the concept of radiocarbon?
Strikingly, that has not led to a lot of success for me.
I'm going to pitch something called the radiocarbon method to the New York Times. I bet they'll give me a wide-eyed write-up. They don't give a shit.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. As long as we put it in the style section, I think you're probably good.
I want my article about it to be next to another article about, you know that pair of absolute freaks who keep having babies, and yes, the woman's got like a little like head like Earthworm Jim and a really long neck, and she wears a bonnet, and the man looks like he is the non-famous one in a semi-gay 80s electro kraut rock duo.
Those
weird fuckers.
Yeah, there's something about the particular shape of glasses that guy has that says I am not right in the head. Like I can present as a reasonably normal person for a limited period of time, but if you dig even slightly beneath the surface, you're gonna find some weird shit.
Just both of them are not in the kinds of glasses that suggests that they actually think that they're going to at any point in the future meet the judgment of their creator.
No, you can't dress the way that woman dresses and think that God's going to approve.
No. Why doesn't she tie her bonnet up? If you're going to wear a bonnet, why are the strings dangling?
It's because she's not a real bonnet head. That's why.
She's not a real bonnet head. She doesn't respect the bonnet.
She's cosplaying. I mean, it really and truly, these people are cosplaying. And the bonnet is a great example of that. Like, that's not how you wear a bonnet. Ask anybody with even a passing knowledge of pre-modern gender norms.
But she's not cosplaying even correctly. She's cosplaying as someone who might cosplay wearing a bonnet.
Yeah. I don't appreciate the layers.
If you don't respect the bonnet will work out a way of disrespecting you.
that's what we always say on this show.
That's the motto. Yeah, that is the motto of this house.
God damn it. I haven't heard a bee in the bonnet joke in ages. That was excellent work, Milo.
Yeah, it doesn't come up often for me either. I won't lie to you.
Yeah, you know, that's. When you get an opportunity, you really got to hop on that.
You really got to hop on.
As you did here. You pounced.
Much like a bee pounces on a bonnet.
Mm.
Okay, so okay. I saw it
a long time ago, and I saw it when I was, I'm just trying to think whether I would have been just about to start my degree or like maybe in the first year of it. But in any case, I was very much in the, who wants to get a big budget blockbuster fucking ruined? Go see it with me. And so I went to see it with, I can't remember who I went to see it with, but I do remember when Brad Pitt shows up saying, and I've said this on mic before, I'm proud of it. I'm not ashamed of what I did. I said, in quite a loud voice, when Brad Pitt appears, why is he wearing a Corinthian helmet? Because obviously in the Bronze Age, he wouldn't have worn a Corinthian helmet, or for that matter, a Corinthian bonnet. So I sort of went into it sort of very much thinking like, oh, you know what? Like I'm no longer kind of like a kind of young blowhard who's really excited to kind of point out the stuff that is wrong with media about a subject that I know about. And what's fun is that stuff, I sort of was like, you know what? Like, fine. It's oral tradition. You can tell and retell in whatsoever a manner as you please. But I did find a bunch of other stuff wrong with it.
Yes.
Which is nothing to do with the representation of the source material or the ancient world. So I'm thrilled to be able to dig into that.
Yeah, as now as you have become an adult, you are ready to critique it as a movie. where there's a whole other rich vein of problems for us to discuss. It's overall ethos.
I've got a lot of problems with you people is my my take on Troy.
I think we all have some grievances to air with a number of the choices that were made in this movie, from the writing to the from the writing to the line delivery.
Yeah. That is Roy on Troy.
Roy on Troy.
Oh, Jesus, man. That's better than I want to admit.
Yeah. It's an episode title. What I had kind of forgotten about this movie is that it's actually pretty it's a pretty good, I mean, realistically for a Hollywood movie, it really captures the vibes of the Iliad, I think. And there's like to the point where they're putting shit in there, like him yelling, "You sack of wine," at Agamemnon, which makes no sense in English, but it's so fun for me to be like, he did say that. Oh, I'm Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm pointing at the screen. I'm like, this is a quote from the actual Iliad in a way that I had forgotten. There's like a, I can't remember exactly what it was now, but there's a bit in the scene where Priam goes to get Hector's body that was also, I thought, very close to the Iliad. It's a good movie. It's a Hollywood movie. It's like they're not making them like this anymore.
I mean, that's true. I would argue with the good movie description there. That is something that I would take issue with.
Aside from your overall point, I'm pretty much in agreement with you.
I accept that it is a Hollywood movie. I'll go along with that.
Yeah, you're with me on the facts. You don't dispute the factual basis of my claim.
No.
I'm about halfway in between you guys. I don't know that I would call it a good movie. I would say it's a really good example of the genre of historical epic, which is something that they have taken away from us in the past 2 decades. They don't really make historical epics like they used to. Milo, I think you're absolutely right about that. There are all sorts of reasons why that's the case. This is one of the last great stabs at the genre, along with the much lamented Alexander, which we discussed at some length. They really don't do them like this anymore. All the ones that they did after this have pretty much flopped, up to Gladiator 2. I think Gladiator 2 is kind of the exception that proves the rule there. The genre really doesn't exist anymore. By the standards of historical epic, I think it's pretty solid. It really hits most of the genre marks pretty well. Is it an objectively good movie? That's a rather more difficult question. Probably not. I think not to put too fine a point on it, but there are interesting things in here. I appreciate how fully they committed to the bit. Like they really went all in. They were like, we're going to make a historical epic, and they really made a historical epic. So, you know, they didn't half-ass it in that regard. And I give them credit for that.
No, I sort of know what you mean. They've sort of gone back to making historical epics a bit, because there's going to be an Odyssey.
Oh yeah,
next year.
No One's Odyssey. Yeah,
which I assume that I'm not going to be able to get out of watching. There's a movie out right at the minute about Odysseus, which is called, I think it's literally called The Return. It's got
But I wouldn't call that
one. I watched it on the plane. Not good.
Okay.
No, Ray Fiennes. They've made him scary ripped. They've made him like old man ripped.
That was going to be my question. How jacked is Ray Fiennes in this as an elderly man?
Alarmingly jacked.
Does he look like a kind of like one of those like kind of scary Scottish fisherman?
Yeah, he's very sinewy.
Like very kind of leathery and muscular, but with like the kind of the crepey skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they've made it into this whole like gritty thing where, you know, like Odysseus is like, he's not even sure he wants to come back, you know. It's like fucking 10 years. They're being very vague about like where he was for 10 years, and like I don't know. It's very like, it just doesn't, it doesn't really capture the vibe of the Odyssey at all. I was not.
I suppose the point is that you kind of want to sort of skirt around the fact that he was on a jolly, wasn't he? Like,
well, a stag do.
He was on his gap year. He was on his 10-year gap year. Like everything that happens in the Odyssey, pretty much, including half of his men getting their clocks cleaned by the Cyclops. Mm. To my mind, counts as a romp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or even a caper.
You'd be in trouble with the wife, wouldn't you? What? It'd be in trouble with the wife. Get home.
10 years.
What? 10 years from over there? Look, I'm not being funny. It's like a week's long sailing journey. So
if I call your mate and ask him, if I put him on speakerphone and ask him, what's he going to tell me? Is he going to be telling me the same story? Oh, we got eaten by a Cyclops. Well, that's very convenient, Odysseus, if I do say so myself.
I'm going to call Sandra, Dave's wife. We're going to see what she has to say about this.
Look at your son. He was a baby when you left. He's now 20.
Mm. Yeah. Oh,
look at the size of him. He's eating me out of house and home. Oh, they got turned into pigs. Oh, now I've heard it all, Odysseus. Now I have heard it all.
Yeah. So tell me more about these sirens. Is that what they're calling the local gentleman's club now? Sirens.
Well, you better hope she's a fucking witch, because she's going to have to turn you back alive after I've killed you.
I noticed somebody has just started following all your socials. Who's Calypso? Yeah. I mean, she looks like she hasn't got any self-respect, but you tell me.
So,
but what is so weird as well is that I think, because I'll tell you what I think destroyed the Sword and Sandal epic. I think it's the relentless process of Marvel Comics universification that has happened over the last 20 years or so, has completely undermined the Sword and Sandal epic as a micro genre, as a kind of cottage industry. Mm-hmm. What I think is weird is that I also think that some aspects of the MCU were invented by this specific movie, because there is a bit which hints at future stories. This bit drives me fucking insane. I hate it so much. I hate it so much. When Paris is speaking to the fleeing Trojans, and there's this kid, and he's like, oh yeah, who are you? And he's like, I'm Aeneas. It's like, no, Aeneas is a full grown man by this point. He's like carrying his dad and his son, like, you know, under his ox, to like he's a pig. I understand why it's there, but it's such end credit scene stuff.
Yeah,
it's such like kind of, I know what that means. I know what that means because I've read the comics. I know what that means, and that's really annoying.
Drawing a straight red line between that I'm Aeneas moment and the bit at the end of Kingsman 2 where they're like, you've got to meet our newest recruit, Adolf Hitler, and then the movie just ends.
Exactly. It's all part of the same continuum. So I think the MCU has kind of undermined the Sword and Sandal epic. I think if they try to do a Troy now, it would end up with like people sort of pointing at the wooden horse and being like, wooden horse, okay. That's normal.
I think that's a really, really good point, to the extent that the Marvel, the big, especially the big kind of like tentpole Marvel movies are essentially, they are epics, right? They follow that same narrative structure. They deal with the same kind of major themes. They're dealing with kind of pathos in the same way as historical epic is. So I think you're absolutely right.
Then there would be a kind of exploitative scene with Prime and Achilles, you know, Prime, like, and everyone starts quoting it, just being like, when Prime says, give me back my son. And you're like, yeah, but also, come on, lads. But what I think is quite funny is that of all ancient poetry, surely the Odyssey is the one which fits in with the kind of the quippy tone the best. So it's really funny to be like, okay, so we're doing the Odyssey, but gritty. It's like, you don't need to do a gritty Odyssey. That's daft. Do a quippy Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I completely agree, but I'm not sure I would call the return epic. It's definitely a period piece, but I'm not sure I would say it's Milo, and based on, this is just solely based on my reading of the trailers, but would you say in terms of the themes that it's dealing, that it's approaching it like Epic, or is it trying to do something more intimate?
It's a very A24 ass movie. That's what I'll say. It's very like, it's very like small scale, you know, it's a lot of like, you know, how, what a state Ithaca is in, you know, that the suitors have been laying waste to the land. And then, I don't know, it's just very like weird. You can't really get into the character of Odysseus at all, because he's just like being like, oh, I'm just an old man. I'm no one. Yeah, yeah, too ripped.
Can't identify with him. We need a plumper Odysseus.
Yeah. And then Telemachus is like, you're not even my real dad. I wish my mom would just fuck one of the suitors. And then the rest of them would leave. And then just suddenly he just kills them all. But there's no like build to it. It's like, yeah, I don't know. It's a fucking weird movie. It's like trying to be like atmospheric, but it doesn't really. It could be a good movie, but it's kind of not. I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Is it one of those ones that has like all the aesthetic markers of a good movie, but when you actually think about it, you're like, no, it sucks.
Yeah, it's very dark also. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're like looking at a scene and you're like, what is that? Yeah, what's happening in there?
When it makes you question whether your eyes have aged faster than the rest of you, then I think there's something wrong with how it was shot.
Yeah,
that's my oldest opinion.
I wish things were lit properly, and I wish they'd speak up.
I think it's fair to say that we've all reached the age where that's a complaint we can make. I think that's 100%. Okay.
I think the reason that I quite enjoyed Dune was because I didn't understand a word anyone was saying. I think that's genuinely why I quite liked it.
Yep.
I just treated it like a music video. Just like,
if you can lean into that, it works great.
Yeah.
So the movie itself,
Pat is going to open with an overarching theory of myth, I believe.
I do. I have an overarching theory of myth that became very clear to me as I was watching this movie, because the inciting event of the movie is obviously Paris stealing Helen from Menelaus. This is the inciting event. Now, what this is fundamentally is the fear of a younger, more attractive man stealing the wife of an older, leathery, sweaty man. Mm-hmm. Always sweaty. The man has to be sweaty. And this is a fear that you can trace throughout the mythological corpus in a variety of different cultures, all the way up to the present day. Anytime you hear a leathery, sweaty, like a tennis or golf guy being worried that the new pro at the club is going to steal his wife, we are reaching deep down into the mythological roots of our culture, to the extent that I think this myth is probably part of our common Indo-European heritage, in the same way as the divine twins, the myth of the serpent and the waters, a kind of a tripartite social structure with workers, warriors, and priests, like deep Indo-European roots. I think the fear of the sweaty guy getting his wife stolen belongs in that same thing. And this movie, great illustration of that mythological myths
that encapsulate the cycling of the seasons, right? Because the rains is the sweat of the sweaty man.
Correct.
And the spring is the young twink adjacent man who appears to steal the wife who is the fruits of summer.
Exactly.
Go along with me on this, guys. You know, yes, don't leave me hanging.
You're the bull, and then later you're the cuck. Yeah, the seasons of life.
Exactly.
Tales old as time.
What is a glowing twink in the morning and a sweaty old man by the afternoon? It's the human. It's the human animal.
That's absolutely true. This is my central thesis about this movie, and it's one of the reasons why it is so resonant, because in every age and place, the fear of the sweaty man getting his wife stolen remains. That just remains a fundamental problem, fundamental issue. Arthurian myth, it's present there. All the way up to Hollywood products of the 21st century, the sweaty man's fear remains culturally central.
Mm.
It's what Citizen Kane's about. Ocean's 11.
This is, yeah, that Ocean's 11. Yes, that is absolutely true. Sweaty E.T. man. What's that?
E.T.
E.T. not the one I was expecting you to drop there, Phoebe. Yeah, that is my overarching thesis about this movie and why the story of the Iliad remains so culturally central. Like, obviously, there's a lot of other stuff in there, but I think the central inciting myth has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm. So we were.
Phoebe wants to know why they didn't include the catalogue of ships.
They do include the catalogue of ships. It's in early aughts CGI. It looks rubbish. It looks like someone has copied and pasted the ship and just been like, when you're at school, if you're allowed to like kind of go hog wild on one of the computers and like you're like, oh, I've got a ship. You know what? I'm going to make more of them. Look, I'm going mad. I'm drunk with copy and pasting power. The screen is full of ships.
Yep. Big Microsoft Paint vibes from the CGI in this movie.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the things that Milo said before we started recording was that it feels very much geared towards people who've actually read the Iliad. I think that's true to an extent, and I've chosen to believe that it's deliberately geared towards people who have read the Iliad and enjoy telling people that this isn't actually the story of the Iliad. I feel like we're having a secret loser signal shone at us by Wolfgang Peterson, who's Jordan Peterson's brother. People don't realize this, but
he's just handing you rules for life in the end credits.
Exactly.
That's classical podcasters.
That's the end credit.
God, that motherfucker really does sound like Kermit the Frog.
The end credits is just like Socrates like chilling out and something being like, how many rules for your life have you got, Socrates? I think I can beat that.
The ancient Greek philosophers were not making their bed, that's for sure.
No.
Do you think Diogenes ever made a bed in his entire life? Absolutely not.
Okay, you know what?
How are you
what?
Even getting like, a mattress in that barrel?
I was going to say, true. Let's be fair to Diogenes. If you're in a barrel, how are you reaching over the barrel to make your bed? You can't do a fitted sheet if you're in a barrel.
No, uh-uh. Not a lot of point anyway.
Not a lot of point.
You have shorn yourself of the bedding to some great degree in your life.
I've got a question about Diogenes. I know it's not strictly relevant, but I feel like I must ask it before we can move on.
Sure.
Do you think that the shoulder straps were internal or external?
Good question.
Mechanistically. Do you think he was wearing it like kind of like a dress?
Or wait, are you saying that Diogenes was wearing the barrel? Like a...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was he not... I thought he just like lived in a barrel that was like in the Agora.
I always envisaged him wearing it.
Yeah.
I thought it was more of a like...
Hobo style.
I always thought it was more of a like kind of a makeshift abode than a item of clothing.
That probably makes more sense, but I've always pictured him wearing it.
Well, they're both, let's be honest, they're both perfectly viable options here. I think you can imagine Diogenes however you want. Have you guys ever seen the now aging comedy movie Talladega Nights? About NASCAR? Yeah, and there's a scene where John C. Reilly is explaining to Will Ferrell how he imagines the baby Jesus. And I think that's, you can imagine Diogenes pretty much the same way. The only canonical
I'm
thing...
I'm looking at some paintings here. People seem to be in camp. He lives in the barrel. It's a big vase on its side, basically.
Yeah.
But apparently it's also a myth. God damn.
The important thing to know about Diogenes is that he just took a shit in the street. The barrel, while entertaining to consider, we really need to focus on the shitting in the street part.
So he wasn't wearing some kind of like nappy.
I would assume,
wasn't he?
Mm. Yeah, maybe.
You really want to?
Who's the real perv? The nappy guy or the guy who's shitting in the street?
Or the guy watching the guy shitting in the street?
Okay, fine. Yeah, okay, fine. That's my answer.
Oh, Jesus. It's like, no one's making you look, bro.
Shall we move away?
I realize that this is partly my doing
because of bringing up his barrel dress. I don't know whether it's really necessary to do like a blow by blow plot summary, because actually, even though it's a very, very long film, it is 14 years long.
Not that much plot.
Like, I started watching it when I was at school. I only finished it a few years ago. That's why I feel pretty confident in what I'm about to say. It is very long, but basically not very much happens. You got your standard. We've got the dinner party where Helen sees Paris and is like, "Fucking hell, is that Orlando Bloom? What's he doing here?
I want that twink obliterated.
Look at the way his bottom jaw doesn't move. He's like Terrence and Philip, which would have been." A salient cultural observation of the time. So you're not allowed to make fun of me for making it.
That was a pretty deep cut, I would Thank say. You. That was.
You know what I mean, though. Like his, whenever he's doing his acting, his everything is like above the lower jawline. He's got this kind of perfectly still, kind of mandible like a chicken.
It's like a very handsome chicken.
Yeah. All I could think watching this.
Yeah, exactly.
All I could think watching this and now reevaluating Paris in the context of 2025, and I think this goes to show how much times have changed, is you're like, if this movie came out today, people would be talking a lot about how Paris likes to get pegged. That's how times have changed since this movie came out. Whereas in the early 2000s, that guy would code very much is going to steal your girl. Now you're like, is he looking for a muscle mommy to
looking for his own one night in Paris?
Which also would have been a salient cultural reference of the time. So well done, Mike.
Yeah. That's, it really would have been. Yeah.
Oh my God. We're really inhabiting the early 2000s here.
We're doing historiography.
We are reconstructing the bygone conditions of a historical period.
This is a pure historicist reading of the 2002 film Troy. Is it 2002 or 2003?
Somewhere
2004.
2004.
So speaking of it being a product of its time, its anti-religion thing is very much like a late 90s, early 2000s new atheism.
Yeah.
Like that is very much of the moment in a way that is shockingly discordant today.
Yeah, that's why Helen likes the look of Paris, because he's got a copy of The God Delusion. She's just like, ooh, yeah. I bet this guy.
So tell me about Richard. Yeah, they initially bonded over their love of Richard Dawkins.
The blind watchmaker. Tell me more.
Paris fuming because at Mycenaean port control, they take his jar of honey off of him. He's like, bloody Jobsworth, honestly.
And if I don't bring that honey through, then I'm going to get so many bees in my bonnet.
It's true. an insane number of bees.
So many bees. I think it's really funny that it says 3,200 years ago at the start. I think that's like, okay, like I understand the point about situating it in history because the energy that that Peterson's bringing is, this is a historical epic. This is not a myth. He's very deliberately he leaves out the gods. He leaves out the series of mythical and divine processes which are behind the Trojan War, because I think it would have made a pretty fun scene to have had the judgment of Paris in there. I think that would have been pretty fun. And then there are quite a lot of kind of attendant myths around it, which also would have been fun. It would have been fun to have Odysseus pretending to be mad to try to get out of it. It's quite odd to have Odysseus as this kind of like, kind of sensible, kind of older, sort of elder statesman type, who sort of shows up, says, "Come on, Achilles, you're a good lad. You're a good lad at home. You don't need to be acting up like this. You don't. No. I know you're a good lad.
Odysseus Bean.
Exactly.
It's the only movie I'm not killed in.
Pretty wild that Sean Bean does manage to survive this one.
Well, I guess they were like, we can't kill off Odysseus.
Yeah, well, he probably insisted on reading the whole thing first, just being like, I'm going right to the end of the... Oh, yeah. He got a sequel. Okay.
Yeah.
He gets the sequel. Fine.
I reckon Peterson tried to kill him off, and Sean Bean turned up with a copy of The Odyssey and was like, you can't be doing that. You see?
It says right here.
Homer's put him in the sequel. And who are we?
Brian Cox tried to do the same thing with Aeschylus, but nothing doing.
they do kill off Menelaus for some reason.
And Agamemnon. Mm-hmm.
Oh, do they? I missed that.
Agamemnon gets killed by...
Sticks a dagger into his neck.
By.
Okay, yeah, that is diverging from the Iliad quite a lot in that case. I thought it was just Menelaus.
No, to a significant degree.
I was very jet-lagged during the watching of this movie, so it's possible I do some micro-sleeps where
Paris
I missed out.
Paris survives it, as does both Andromache and Astyanax. I understand why it is a Hollywood movie, but I think that's one of the issues I have with it, which is if you're going to go down the purely kind of, you know what, no, fuck this, we're not doing the myths, we're not doing the gods, we're not doing the reason Troy gets destroyed, because it's baked in too... It's baked into the foundation myth. The original kings of Troy failed to pay the gods who helped build the walls, and they said, okay, so several generations down, one of your like great great grandsons is gonna be kind of the ruin of the city. Is gonna bring on the ruin of the city. Like they leave out the stuff that Helen goes with Paris because she has been bewitched by, one of the goddesses who loses out in the judgment of Paris. All that stuff is left out in favor of this is how we're doing it. War is hell. To the ancients, war was hell. It was a fact of life. It was a way of structuring the year. It was a way of structuring every single part of your foreign policy, pretty much. It's like, it's war and trade. But functionally, it's really, really bad, and it sucks. And there's lots and lots of it. And there's lots of it that sucks. And that's what we're going to approach in a historical epic. I think if you're going down that line, you can't get squeamish. And it is a very, very squeamish film.
Yes.
There's basically no violence. There's a very, it's a very kind of pointed look. Hector's son, who is very much not being killed, is being borne off to safety by Andromache. We don't see any of the Trojan princesses being kind of clapped into slavery. We don't have the rape of Cassandra. Not saying that I particularly want to see that. Cassandra's not in it at all, I don't think.
She wouldn't be in it.
You know what? Well, as soon as Wolfgang dropped that script round, I knew. But no one listened to me.
No one listened to me.
I knew I was going to be left out. So I think that's sort of like one of the things that's wrong with it. But yeah, please do.
So do you guys want to talk a little bit about kind of the actual historical background here in the Late Bronze Age, and to what extent this does reflect the... Okay, so this is a topic I spent quite a bit of time on. I did a lot of research on it. I wrote a chapter of my book about the Late Bronze Age in the Aegean. And so I'm up to date on all the recent research on this. The basics of it are this. The Iliad as a story is part of a cycle of texts, of which the Iliad and the Odyssey are the only ones that survive. But there was a whole body of literature in the ancient world about Troy, about this war, about probably a series of wars. And most of those texts do not survive. Pretty much all that's left to us of what was once a much larger corpus of literature is this. So basically for as long as people have been thinking about the Iliad and this underlying conflict, people have been asking whether or not it was real. The basic answer to that seems to have been yes, that there were a lot of conflicts in the Bronze Age Aegean. There was a city, the memory of which became Troy to the Greeks. It was also known as Ilium or Ilion. And that is probably a corruption of its actual name, which was in the Luvian language. It was probably Willusa. The site of Troy, there was a city, there were multiple cities on that site. The archaeological occupation on the site, it's called Hisarlik. It's in Western Turkey. It was occupied from at least the early Bronze Age. I think the earliest remains on the site are from 2500, 2200 BC, somewhere in that range. So early Aegean Bronze Age. The city was actually destroyed multiple times. But there was an iteration of the city on that site that largely matches the descriptions provided in the Iliad as a pretty major urban center, trading port, big walls. There was a place on that site that was destroyed around 1180 BC in what we call the Bronze Age Collapse, as part of this kind of broader, set of collapses that happened in the Eastern Mediterranean around this time. So the idea of there having been an overking who kind of united all of the smaller kingdoms in Greece, perfectly plausible. That we have source texts, not so much from the pre-Greeks themselves, from the Mycenaeans. The texts that we have from the Mycenaeans are exclusively administrative. So they're like lists of things that were kept in storehouses and palaces. We don't really have any narrative texts from the Mycenaean world written in a script called Linear B. It's Mycenaean language, very clearly the ancestor of later Greek. We do have a lot of texts from the Hittites and to a lesser extent from the Egyptians talking about things that were happening in the Aegean and the people who lived there. They call this region Ahiawa, which is almost certainly a corruption or translation of Homer's Achaeans, which is the collective term he uses for the Greeks. The reading between the lines of those texts, they describe a world of small-scale kings with occasional kings who were able to unite them and turn them into a larger polity. So there was no like Greece per se. There were lots of kings in Greece. Occasionally, some of those kings became powerful. Perfectly plausible that one of them is a kind of an Agamemnon figure who is able to put together an army big enough to go take Troy. That is all largely consonant with this world as we understand it, in which large-scale warfare was pretty endemic. So was raiding. This was a violent world in which warrior elites wielded a lot of power and authority. That is 100% accurate. There are interesting details in the Iliad too that speak to a kind of a cultural memory of this earlier period. There are details in there that really did come down from this earlier period. So the Iliad talks a lot about boar's tusk helmets. So helmets that are made using like you take little pieces of boar's tusk and you slice them thin and you use that as kind of the covering of the helmet, like the hard exterior of the helmet. Not something that existed in Iron Age Greece at all, but very common in the archaeological record of Bronze Age Greece. So this is clearly a thing that they knew had existed before. It remains as kind of a trope or a kind of an element in these stories that the author can pull out whenever he or she wants. So there are clearly aspects of this earlier period, memories, ideas, stories that survive, that get wound up into the Homeric corpus, which is really interesting that, you know, you can be 400 or 500 years after the fact, and there are still ideas of things that happened that are floating around that are probably coming straight from that period that end up in the texts that we have now. The catalog of ships also probably an accurate reflection of the political geography of Mycenaean Greece. The places that are listed in the catalog of ships were prominent in Mycenaean Greece. The archaeological record confirms that most of the places that are listed in the catalog of ships did have Mycenaean period occupations. But interestingly, they are places that were not prominent at all in Iron Age Greece. So this is probably an accurate reflection to some degree of the political geography of that time. That's kind of the historical basis of it. As far as the visuals of the movie, no, they don't especially well match that period. But the kind of overall world of petty kings, alliances, warfare as a kind of a major seasonal activity, all of that is pretty consonant with that world.
Yeah, it was like going skiing or, you know, strawberry picking.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah, during the war season.
It, there was a war season. There was a time when you went out and did that. And if you were a particular type of guy, then that was what you did at that time of year. If you look at the burial record of Mycenaean Greece, especially elite male graves, there's tons of evidence for violence. There are tons of skeletal markers of trauma. A lot of people who died younger than they probably should have. To be an elite man in the Mycenaean world involved pretty regular exposure to violence.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that the sort of this stuff does have a kind of moderate factual basis. I mean, obviously the Iliad as a text is like, as Phoebe and you have both alluded to already, is like, it's very mythological in its portrayal. There's like, the gods are incredibly prominent in it. There's a huge amount of stuff about all kinds of like divine intervention and deus ex machina stuff, which they've left out of the movie. And in that sort of perverse way makes it kind of slightly closer to like potentially like a realistic portrayal of what might have happened, even though it actually departs from the text significantly. But then also they are messing around with the historical record quite a lot insofar as there is a historical record. We don't get any Astyanax thrown from the walls of Troy. Fucking Menelaus and Agamemnon both die. They're not really closely sticking to it, even though there's like a lot of this kind of close aesthetic inclusion of stuff from the Iliad, like the actual lines of it directly translated and put into the movie, which is weird because it does feel like an Easter egg that's aimed just at us.
100%. Yeah, it's I'm really interested in it because it's not entirely clear to me, it's just a melange of stuff. It's just a potpourri of different elements. And for me, it mostly works. I'm mostly fine with it. I think it's an interesting movie to think with about some of these dynamics. It also shows you how much the world has changed, because watching this, I think when I was younger, I was like, oh, Achilles, not great, but, you know, he's a hero. And now watching it, I'm like, that guy sucked.
Yeah, he sucked.
He was a real piece of shit.
He's a real piece of shit. But again, another thing that we were talking about, like Pat, thank you very much for that extremely comprehensive and detailed description. I'm sure that you will be delighted to hear that my contribution is as intellectually sound as that, and definitely doesn't. It's definitely just not a note which I've got here saying Trojan cycle, it's like Soul Cycle, but you've got to be on wooden horses. That's definitely not a note that I've got here. It was something much
still accurate,
much
I don't see the but again, you know, what's the trope? Soul Cycle instructor steals your girl.
Exactly.
Although he's also sweaty
this is where the traditions dovetail, and this is where like they kind of come background and meet each other, which is when the young guy is also sweaty. Everyone's sweaty in it. I think something that we were talking about in the chat, in the secret chat, which the listeners have no access to, probably just as well.
It's not great, guys.
It's not good. It's not good.
It's very much they have no access to the chat. And it's like, well, yeah, because that's where we plan the podcast.
There wouldn't be any need
for them to be in
but
the.
Like, we don't like post. We don't like post extracts from the chat.
No.
For example.
No.
They don't get any. Your Patreon money doesn't get you any kind of further into the kind of belly of the beast.
Like, well, it's all in linear B anyway, so it'd be hard to understand.
Exactly. You're not getting in the labyrinth, guys. Yeah.
If you've been trained as a Mycenaean scribe, we'll let you in.
We'll let you in. Because otherwise, your skill set is dying out and you're very valuable. So
we'll let you in. This is also the last place in the world where you can learn linear A. I don't know if that appeals to any of you, but yeah, that undeciphered language, we cracked it in the group chat. So
specifically so that it wouldn't be decipherable by anyone. That's exactly. We know linear A and we're gatekeeping the knowledge so that we can, you know, slag off whoever we want in the group chat.
Yeah, if you want to know what linear A means, then just comment linear under this post. And inbox you the details. Yeah.
Make sure you get that hashtag in there.
Make sure you get that hashtag. So Helen sees Paris and she's just like, hey, look at that. Look at his jaw. And everyone's like, it's fucking Legolas. Shit. Why is he here? Why is he here? It's one of those things where you watch this movie and you're like, God, it was like such a different time. It was like such a different time when like everyone was just being expected to go along with Orlando Bloom being a leading man. Everyone was just, you know,
Pirates of the Caribbean, same year.
It was just such a kind of sort of lost past, really, when we're being expected to go along with.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
This guy's an actor for money. This is something that he
Kingdom of Heaven shortly after this.
He gets paid to do this. He gets paid millions and millions of dollars to do this, and that's fine.
Actor for money. Never his lower jaw will move. I don't know. We can riff this out.
That's beautiful. I like
it. Yeah, thank you.
I really like it. Thanks, man. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Now that you're mentioning it, I don't think I've ever seen his lower jaw move. No. Not one time. He's very much the opposite of a snake.
Yeah, exactly. He is the opposite of a snake. Or as far as Menelaus goes, he is not the opposite of a snake. But for everyone else, he is the opposite of a snake. I remember what I was talking about before I got distracted by the idea of linear A in the group chat, which is that they don't know quite what to do, or no one in the contemporary period knows what to do with the age of heroes, because in ancient poetry, a hero just means somebody with some kind of divine ancestry who does a lot of fighting. And the issue is a little bit muddled by heroes like Odysseus, Perseus, Theseus, and so on, who do kind of recognizably heroic things. They go on adventures, they go on quests, they rescue girlies, and they slay monsters. But most of the heroes of the Age of Heroes are just pricks. Just like armored pricks. Armored ocean-going pricks. That's all they are. They just kill a lot of people. And so when you're trying to kind of persuade us of Achilles as maybe not the hero of the film, but like the kind of the troubled anti-hero, like the main character of the film, you can't just have him being a grumpy rapist who fancies his cousin, who like nearly like undermines an entire war effort because another boy stole his toy. You can't have that. So you have to pretend that he's actually in love with Briseis, which again is squeamish. It's like, again, I don't particularly want to watch three hours of different Greek soldiers raping this woman. Of course I don't. Like, I don't want to see that at all. But his concern for Briseis is not that Agamemnon's gonna go off with her and do some harm to her. It's his toy. She's his. He called Bagsy. He Bagsied the Trojan princess. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work that Patroclus is his cousin and not his lover. More squeamishness, by the way. Because again, his fury at the death of his lover is like, it's partly about him. And they sort of try and kind of gussy it up as, you know, he's very sad about the death of his young cousin, who he promised his mom he would protect. But because they try and cram everything from the Trojan cycle into the film, the pacing is slightly odd. So we really go into a kind of a, we're going to war. We have like a kind of interesting bit right at the start where Achilles like fights the champion of Thessaly, which is like, it's a cool scene. He jumps up in the air and he sticks his sword, you know, into his shoulder. And then Orlando Bloom's watching, just being like, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I could like jump up in the air like an idiot and everyone will think it's cool. Maybe I could do that. I have put here, why don't they just drop a big rock on Achilles? Because he can't be killed, but he can definitely be trapped. And you could just break every bone in his body. Why not? I have some more complaints about Achilles's immortality. But that's at the end. Also, I've got another complaint straight up, which is when they show Greece, it's covered in ruined temples. Why?
Yeah, what period are the ruins from?
Why? Yeah. at least one of these ruins is like from the 5th century. So why is that there? Why is there a ruin from the future?
Yeah, tell me more about the presence of Tholos tombs in the landscape of Mycenaean Greece and their cultural meaning to the generations who came after. That's somehow, I don't think they were operating on that level.
No,
when they shot those scenes.
I've got a Linear B joke in here.
Oh, let's hear it.
I remember, which is it. Honestly, Pat, you're going to be so disappointed. Which is cousin is Linear B for twink. That's just that's what I've got. That's what I've got here.
In a logographic writing system, that could absolutely be the truth.
It absolutely could be. We have another complaint before we dive into the plot. Which is why is Achilles wearing a Free People cohort? And why is he dressed as Sienna Miller at Glasgow in 2005?
Well, actually, Sienna Miller at Glasgow in 2005 was dressed as Achilles. That was the bit. The theme that year was heroes.
I'll allow it. But like, what are those? What's that little like kind of?
You should have seen Jarvis Cocker as Thetis. That was really quite something.
I want to come back to the idea of Achilles being a piece of shit real quick.
Yeah.
Because it is culturally important for us to understand that A, that Achilles is a piece of shit, and B, why he is a piece of shit, right? Because the whole point of the Iliad, and this is the whole point of a great deal of ancient epic, which is what makes ancient epic more interesting than it's often made out to be, is that it is not a full-throated endorsement of heroes like Achilles.
No.
These texts are in large part an attempt to deconstruct what a hero is and what their impact is on the society around them. That's one of the things that makes these enduring and interesting texts. Same deal with the Epic of Gilgamesh, right? The Aeneid too is in large part about what is the impact of having a hero like this? What does this do to the world around them? What is their broader salience? And this movie, by choosing to make Achilles the hero, kind of misses that. It really misses a lot of what makes this an interesting text as a text, which is that these guys do suck. The world is worse because of them. Mm. The world is worse because there is a guy like Achilles out there stabbing a noble prince and dragging his body around the city tied to his chariot. That's bad.
Yeah, because even that is framed as being like, not ideal, but understandable given what has just happened with the death of Patroclus. What I think I totally agree with you. And I think that's something that is missing if you insist on stripping out the divine and mythological elements, which is the fact is that in the Iliad, it's pretty apparent the hero of the Iliad is simply not Achilles. The hero of the Iliad is Hector.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean that Hector is not doomed. Yes. Hector is doomed because of capricious divine forces utterly outside of his control. Hector's fate was sealed generations before when his forefathers made the error of annoying the gods. The whole point of it is not that Troy is in the wrong. It's not that Troy is an innocent victim being besieged. It's none of that. It's that there are two civilizations at war. The gods have gone, I pick you. And so whoever is leading the ones who do not get picked is doomed. And he is the moral center of the poem. He does everything right. He does everything that a hero who is supposed to exist as a kind of moral instructor does, but he's still doomed. He's still cooked because that's not really what it's about. And they've kind of tied themselves up in some knots because they're a bit like, okay, well, Hector seems like an all right kind of guy. Do we have to? Yeah, I guess we do. But Achilles is the main character, so I guess that's... Hang on. And like every so often you have a kind of a bit of an attempt to go with this, you know, the gods have abandoned you. But it's much more visceral if you read the poem or if you look at any of the artwork. There's a really hideous vase which shows the naked Cassandra who's either just been attacked by Ajax or she's about to be attacked. And she is pleading with the statue of Athena to intervene on her behalf. Or she's kind of holding her arms out in supplication to the statue of Athena. And the statue has its eyes averted. And this is symbolic that the gods have abandoned Troy. Because there were gods of Troy. Like Apollo was a god sympathetic to Troy. But towards the end of the war, because the gods are capricious and they are not particularly interested in people, they have their favorites and then they have their worst people and they pick them up and then put them down again. So if you miss that, then you miss the kind of the essential pathos of the only legitimate hero being Hector, but it makes no difference.
Yeah, you and really because 100%, and what you've hit on there is the difference between the ancient Greek worldview and our own, right? That in to the ancient Greeks, to a very great degree, you were not in control. You were a plaything of capricious gods. And your moral quality and moral fiber were not going to save you ever if the gods decided that it was time for you to go down. And I mean, we got to sit with that for a minute, like really internalize that, because that's a huge, huge, huge difference in mindset between the ancient and the modern worlds. We are so used to thinking that we have control of our destinies and that it's our choices and our moral quality that determine our destiny and the path of our lives. And the ancient Greeks did not think that way. And to your point, when you talk about the squeamishness here, a really fundamental fact about the ancient world, and this was true pretty much anywhere you looked, in war, the victor had the fundamental right to dispose of the conquered in any fashion he chose. Any fashion, period. If you were defeated in war, you lost all of your rights. You lost your personhood. You were no longer a person in the way that you had been before that. And so this is the whole thing with Perseus, which you're absolutely right. We're turning it into a love story is to miss the point that when she was captured, she lost her humanity. She became an animate object to the people who are involved in that. And I can't overemphasize this. You got to sit with that. You gotta really try and internalize what that means and what that says about the difference in worldview here. And if you can't sit with that, which this movie can't, it cannot do that. It cannot fully comprehend or internalize what that means, then you're going to miss some really key facet of how that world functioned, how people thought. And you're going to end up making what amounts to a costume drama, which is what this is. It's not that there's nothing that we can talk about with the late Bronze Age. It's not that there's nothing that we can talk about with regard to its connection to the Iliad, but we've talked about this before, this distinction between costume dramas and actual like films or TV shows that try to inhabit the spirit and mentality of the time and place. That's what makes this a costume drama, is that it can't sit with that. It can't internalize it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Exactly like that.
Well, but no, I mean, you really and truly, you hit you recognize the squeamishness that this has And that's really reflective of its fundamental problem as a commentary on history and myth. If you can't take seriously your source material's concerns, then at the end of the day, you're not going to get it. And that whole, like, it was kind of a throwaway thing when I noticed this, the kind of new atheism of the movie. Mm. But now that I'm thinking about it, I think that's actually really central to why this doesn't fully work. Because if you can't take seriously that the gods were real to these people and that they mattered to the way that they behaved in the world, then you're never going to make sense of it. You're always going to be somehow sneering at these people or trying to make them fit your world, and they don't fit there because they're not of this time and place. Mm.
Yeah.
I recognize this as I get older and I gain more of a sense of historical perspective on my life. But like, I think it's hard for people who are even 10 years younger than I am to fully understand just how like sexualized teenage girls were in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Mm. Yeah. Right?
Like the extent to which this was a totally normal and basically accepted facet of society that like you were supposed to look at 16-year-old Britney Spears in a midriff bearing thing and think that is the paragon of like sexual desirability. Right. Yeah. And to people who are even a few years younger than I am, like that's really hard to understand, but that was the case. Like that was the world that we were all living in. That was the water that we were swimming in. And if you can't take that, I mean, and that's recent, right? Like if you can't take seriously the idea of changing mentalities, that doesn't mean excusing behaviors or saying it's okay, but you have to understand the fundamental difference there.
Yeah, exactly. So why we're being historicist by making jokes about Paris Hilton and South Park. And they should have done the same thing. They should have learned from our, you know.
They should have brought it in by analogy, you know, sort of Achilles is like the Cartman of the Troad. You know?
Exactly.
You're not supposed to like him, but he is powerful.
Yes, heck of when.
So I had one more follow-up on that. Oh yeah, the inability to treat Achilles as the piece of shit that he really is, and which is not solely restricted to this movie. That's true of a lot of kind of modern takes on Achilles.
But and that's not a controversial view in the ancient world, right? I mean, like Achilles is kind of known as like a mercurial, like difficult figure. He's not thought of as being like a good guy. He's thought of as being a great warrior, like, which is a different thing.
The first word of the Iliad is not like, you know, great guy. It's anger, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so this is not us doing revisionism on the figure of Achilles. Like this was stuff people in the ancient world talked about a lot, but the inability to treat Achilles that way also leads us to misunderstand other ancient figures who saw kinship with Achilles. The primary example of this is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was fucking obsessed with Achilles to the point that when Alexander crosses into Asia, one of the very first things he does is goes to what is reputed to be the site of Troy, and he exchanges his own armor for the armor that is supposed to have been Achilles. And Alexander the Great identified himself with Achilles, and there is a great degree to which you can understand Alexander the Great's career as being an attempt to create the circumstances to have larger and larger battles to allow him to play Achilles.
It's like a kid like wearing a messy shirt.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly it. That is exactly
he's wearing Achilles' kit. It's his lucky kit.
Yes, it's a French kid wearing a Thierry Henry jersey. Yeah. That's the like this. This is it's a kid wearing a Messi jersey. It's a kid wearing a Ronaldo jersey, and if you fail to understand the extent to which Achilles was a piece of shit and was understood to be a piece of shit, you miss one of the things that one of these huge, like glaring red flags about Alexander the Great, where you're like, oh, maybe not like a cool visionary conqueror, maybe just a murderer who was obsessed with his own image and prestige and the idea of being remembered. Mm. That, that gives you a different reading of Alexander the Great. You
perhaps
know?
A better analogy
would
be...
He was also Irish.
Yeah, that's right. Alexander the Great putting on a Cristiano Ronaldo jersey.
Yeah.
Great footballer, troubling legacy.
Alexander the Great putting on a Harry Kane legacy because he's a jersey rather, because he's a... You know, because he's abandoning his own heritage because he's Irish.
Yeah, going to Bayern. Going to Bayern, rough equivalent of Alexander the Great recruiting a bunch of guys from Asia for his army. Yeah. Same deal.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
We have rendered explicable the transfer of Harry Kane to Bayern. Thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah, that's right. Trying to figure out what the ancient Greek equivalent of going to play in the Saudi league is, but we'll get there.
Taking up mercenary work in the Western Mediterranean, I think.
Yeah.
There's okay. So this is actually
getting
a thing
stationed
that happens
at the east face of Helicon.
Yeah. This is actually a thing that happens kind of later once you get into the Hellenistic age. So Sparta is no longer like a military powerhouse as a city, right? Like the Spartans are not a major power within Greece. They've been outclassed by all of these larger polities. But individual
you know
Spartans.
Why? It's because of the way they decorated their houses. People were getting much more kind of maximalist. They're much more interested in, you know, fabrics, designs. They were looking in these houses, just being like, it's a lot of gray.
And frankly,
a lot of gray.
They found better ways to exploit the peasantry, like helotage, really. Like you're gonna stick with that. There are so many better ways to exploit your social inferiors. But so the Spartans were no longer military powerhouses, but they were still highly sought after on like an individual basis. You'd be like, oh, we got a Spartan to come train our guys. Like this is a really big deal. And that really is the Saudi League. It's these like old kind of grizzled Spartans with a lot of prestige who are like, you know what, for the closing act of my career, I'm going to go to Syracuse and I'm going to train a bunch of guys. And this is I'm going to make a ton of money. And then after that, I'm going to go home back to my coterie of femboys.
Jordan Henderson holding up a big Syracuse helmet and being like, I've never been prouder to play for Syracuse.
Yes, exactly. James Milner going back to Newcastle for one last match. That kind of, it'd be something like that.
Please insert an extended bit there about Jordan Henderson calling the Tyrannos gaffer. we don't actually have time, so I'm not going to do my Jordan Henderson impression, but know that it exists and know that it's there.
Yeah, Tyrannos was the original gaffer when you think about it.
Exactly.
Yeah, what would you like, I'm just trying to imagine in a really thick Yorkshire accent saying strategos. Like that's really the vibe I'm searching for here. We could do a lot with this bit if we wanted to. I think it's probably good that we're not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the benefit of the listener, we're choosing not to.
we're choosing not to go down the road of Jordan Henderson saying strategos.
Yeah.
Jordan Henderson is also not from Yorkshire. He's a Geordie.
Really? Yeah. I don't know why I associate him so strongly with Liverpool. So.
Which is also not in Yorkshire. Oh my God, Pat, you're going to get into
so Northern
much
England,
trouble.
For fuck's sake. Just, God damn it. I am still American. I try, but I am still
watching
American.
You flail there, Pat. I was like, oh no. He's walked right into our trap.
Sake. Yeah. I know. I'm sorry. Also, you have to understand, I have been sleeping on a cot for two weeks. Do you know the size of me? Do you know how big I am?
You're a big fella.
Do you think I fit on a cot? Like, this is, so I would say if my brain is scrambled and I have forgotten my geography and place of origin of Jordan Henderson.
And you know what? Now I think about it, I think he might be from Sunderland.
Yeah,
so
long-time Premier League journeyman Jordan Henderson. My ability to precisely locate him in the
right. What else do we have to say about this movie?
I have quite a. I have quite a lot just in my just.
Let's hear.
Notes.
Let's so run through. Just, let's do the ritualistic rundown of Phoebe's notes.
Okay. Right. There's a general complaint about their hair. I don't like both Paris and Hector's hair. It's got too much volume at the crown and not enough at the roots. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do not, but I believe you.
It looks like we've had like some texturizing spray and a little bit of back combing, but then like that, but then the smoothing over the top has fallen flat. I don't know if they've not used enough hairspray or something. I don't know. I don't like the hair.
Eric Banner's been doing the Aussie 1 minute miracle, and he's taken it too far.
Exactly.
I don't know enough. I neither know he's enough
left
about
on for
nor
6 minutes.
I neither know enough about nor have enough hair to be able to comment on that.
Okay. Then there's like that they're suggesting that Achilles' anger at Agamemnon is one of protectiveness. Oh, then there's an aside here, which is I would be really rubbish in a siege situation. I'd probably hold out for maybe a week.
Yeah.
Before I just be like, you know what, like fuck this. Can you just tell them to go away? I want some crisps.
Yeah. I want the chewy teeth.
Why are they still out there? Can you ask one of them to go and get me some crisps? Mm. Because I didn't get enough. I didn't realize we were going
to
be
in the Iliad where they have to let the Uber Eats guy through.
Yeah, like can you just let him through? Oh yeah, no, I know. No. Your sat nav sends you to Volusia, but this is Troy. This is the right one. So I'll just come down and meet you. Can you get out of my way?
Yeah. No, you gotta go around the Achaeans. Yeah. Yeah, sorry about that. It's roadworks. Yeah.
I've said that the bit where he's putting on this is a deep cut. I've said that the bit where he's putting on the armor is like the getting ready scene that they had at the start of a particular sort of 80s film. Mm-hmm. I'm specifically thinking of the getting ready scene at the start of Pretty in Pink, but it could be any film where you have an open credit scene which shows like a woman like putting on her tights and like doing her makeup and it's all close up. That's what the putting on the armor bit is like. Another complaint about the hair, which is that both Hector and Paris have little Claire's accessories, deedlies, in their hair, kind of throughout their hair. Interwoven. Oh, we have some of the chanty ancient world music. When Hector dies. Mm. So that's fun. Achilles looks like a little prep school shithead on a hobby horse in his chariot. Mm-hmm. When the Trojans are watching Hector die, they all just look a bit uncomfortable. They don't look like this is their last hope being extinguished in front of their eyes. And his corpse being desecrated. They look like they've kind of stumbled across, like they look like a couple is fighting in front of them. That's what they look like. They're just making kind of, oh God, look at this. Mm, look at this shit.
This is awkward.
There's when Priam shows up and speaks to Achilles, because Brad Pitt, look, all right, you know what? I'm going to go controversial here. Brad Pitt's not a very good actor. I know he is a very prolific actor, but he's not a very good one. He's got a bit of the lower jaw issue as well, if you ask me. It's just that he's been around for ages. He's like one of those people. He's just like, oh, yeah, I suppose we've got to pretend because he's just been around for ages. He's like Bruce Forsyth.
He reaches the point, and I think this might be the movie where he reaches that point where he's just playing Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
he's like at a remarkably early age for an actor to begin playing himself or variations on himself. Cause I think he's only in his like mid to late 30s when he did Troy.
Yeah. He's not especially older.
Yeah. But by the time he finishes this movie, cause I think the movie he did after this was Mr. and Mrs. Smith. By that point, he's clearly just playing Brad Pitt.
Mm. God, what a movie.
And this is the last movie where I think he's actually trying to act, like trying to fully inhabit another character.
What that means is that every time someone shows up who's not, because like whenever he's in a scene with Patroclus, they look like they've just been like they've just like got done like watching top 10 BMX fails. That's what we get out of them. But like when Priam shows up and says, "Oh, will you give me back the body of my son?" He kind of looks at him. He kind of sort of looks at him like in this kind of affronted way, and it looks like. What I've put here is he looks at him like a cat who's had someone sit in its chair. Mm-hmm. So he just sort of goes like, what are you doing here? Get out of my chair. Mm. So I like how they do the horse thing because they don't explain it like in any way, shape or form. They literally just have it as a kind of a, Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think it's time. I think it's time to send in the horse. Send in the horse. What do you mean send in the horse?
Yeah.
You know, I brought this with me just in
people
case.
People on set like horse.
Yeah, it's, you know, I thought it would be kooky. It's definitely kooky. What? They're not going to fall for that, you dickhead. Like, what? Like, why would a city who has just lost their greatest warrior and an heir to the throne, who is losing this war, why would their aggressor suddenly, after 10 years, go, we're just going to leave. We're just going to pack up and go home. We're just going to leave you this. We're going to leave you this, like, evidently hollow thing. Why is it in the shape of a horse? I like horses. I like the way they, you know, run through the field. I like their flanks. Mm.
What would the use of a big wooden horse be? It's a bit of an albatross around your neck. What are you going to do with it afterwards? Fit on Airbnb?
Yeah, what are you... To be fair, you could probably do quite well on Airbnb with the, with the wooden horse.
The horse girls, like, the Taylor
Swift
fans.
But also, yeah, like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with it afterwards? Like, this is a one-wear purchase, this thing. It's like a wedding dress. Why have we done that? Yeah, and they make it completely unclear why the Trojans fall for it, and it's almost like a kind of afterthought, which I get why it's an afterthought, because it's not in the Iliad, it's not part of the story of the Iliad, but also then why put it in at all? Like, I understand that it's like, you know, the end of the war, but like it still feels very kind of like, oh shit, we've still got to send in the horse. Do we have a horse? No. You know what? So originally it was going to be a dragon or another kind of really kind of mystical beast. But then, you know, we ran out of budget on buying Brad Pitt cords from Free People. So it is a horse
expensive.
Now. Is that okay? We've had to really dial back our expectations. I think the Trojans and the Greeks should have more differentiated armor. Because when they're fighting, you can't tell the difference between them, and I feel like they should look a bit more different for the fight scenes. There's a very kind of abrupt finish. It's very like kind of oh that's it, okay fine. I have another complaint about Achilles's immortality. Mm-hmm. So he gets shot in the heel with an arrow. That's the power. Paris, the last thing that Apollo does for his favored city is he guides the hand of Paris.
Yeah,
you don't. That's not in the film, obviously.
Well, he does an Achilles, which, to be fair, is often a career-ending injury.
Exactly. So he's got to go off to play for LA Galaxy after that, because after he gets, you know, shot in the because Achilles tendon, like David Beckham. Achilles tendon injury.
I'm with you.
Off to play for LA. We're bored. All right. So, first of all, if she should have gone back and just got the heel, fine. She didn't do that. That was a mistake.
You can dip twice on her part.
You could have dipped.
Yeah, why can't you switch hands?
You can double dip the boy. You can double dip your boy.
Why not?
Personally, I would have set the heel in jelly or whatever, or, you know, cement, things of this nature. So is the heel, according to the concept of how it works in, as far as I can tell, in ancient mythology, is that his mortality is contained within the heel. So, like, not like all of his, like, internal organs, like, kind of crash down tiny in his heel, but, like, it is the site of his mortality. If you shoot him in the heel, that's it. That's what does him in. That's like shooting him right through the heart. But what it seems to suggest in the film is that his heel's like Kevlar, so he gets shot in the heel, and that undermines the integrity of the immortality of the rest of his body, so then he gets shot through the heart. And that doesn't make any sense at all.
He's in this movie, he's never immortal. He's just the greatest warrior. That's why he says, when the boy asks him if he's immortal, he says, if I were immortal, I wouldn't be bothering with the shield, would I?
Mm.
So he's not actually immortal at all. He gets shot in the ankle, or he gets shot in the Achilles heel with
that,
the arrow.
That slows him down.
And then if you notice, when they find his body, he has pulled out all of the other arrows, and the only one that's left is the one in his ankle, or is the one in his Achilles heel. So when they find him, they think it was the arrow to his Achilles that killed him, when it was actually the arrows to his torso.
Okay,
that's,
you know,
my
what?
Understanding.
That does make sense, and I feel like I wasted quite a lot of time coming up with my Kevlar analogy, but I think it's a good one. I stand by it. I stand by it as an analogy. I had another point about not knowing how to approach a hero as the ancients would have thought of a hero. And I thought the corollary was, were medieval knights, mm-hmm. like the code of chivalry. I thought that was
a
fun analogy. Like, people don't really know what that means.
Yeah. So that's a really good parallel, where our modern understanding of what chivalry is like, oh, you should be like nice to ladies and stuff like that. No. Chivalry as it existed for medieval knights was your prowess. It was your ability to effectively do violence, preferably in sight of other people who were also capable of doing violence and could give you your flowers for doing violence well enough.
Yeah.
That's all chivalry was. This whole idea of like courtly love, of, you know, honor, much later accretions onto the basic idea of chivalry, which was always focused around violence. And ancient heroism, same deal, right? Like, ancient heroism is defined by your prowess, your ability to do violence, your ability to be lauded for doing violence. Like, that's what it is. Everything else is window dressing.
Yeah. My other complaint is that, like, Diane Kruger, while a very pretty lady, it's very difficult to cast Helen, who is supposed to be the most beautiful woman, like, kind of, you know, living or dead. But like, she's a bit wet, isn't she, Helen? She's a bit like kind of.
She's not had to develop a personality due to being the most attractive woman who's ever lived.
Yeah, but like, we've got, because Briseis is a bit more feisty. I actually think that Rose Byrne, I think would have made a better Helen.
I can see that.
I think she has a sort.
She's certainly a deeper character. It's still not like the women in this movie have a lot of agency, but
they don't have a lot to do. But if he's not literally meant to be immortal, then why is the when he goes to see his mummy, the sea nymph, who's the only divine character?
They can't sit with it, Phoebe. This is the fundamental problem. This movie cannot sit and fully absorb the idea of understanding the world differently. It is incapable of that act of translation. Right? And if it's not capable of doing that, you're going to end up in some fucking weird places. Yeah. And this is, so you're absolutely right, because like the whole thing with his mother makes no goddamn sense if you completely ditch the idea of the divine.
Yeah.
Right. But this movie is otherwise completely dedicated to the idea that the gods are nonsense. So how do you deal with that? That leads you to these kind of internal contradictions, which is the weakness of the movie. A lot of strengths, a lot of interesting stuff we can talk about with it. But yeah, it's neither an adaptation of the Iliad nor a historical epic. It's a weird thing in between them that can't decide exactly what it wants to be, but is nevertheless not terrible.
An enjoyable watch.
Odysseus is too jovial. He's too jovial.
Yeah.
Well, if you want non-jovial Odysseus, watch The Return. That's all I can say.
Watch The Return.
What miserable Odysseus. No vibes Odysseus.
And Odysseus was all about vibes. Yeah.
He was.
What a missed opportunity.
Wow. Odysseus sus.
And the boys.
No, that's no good. That's no good.
Anyway.
I hate that.
Well, what's more sus than hanging out with your boys for 20 years? So that was the film, Troy. Thanks very much for being a Patreon subscriber. I think this is a Patreon one. We appreciate you. And your ongoing support of the show. You make the show possible. So thank you very much. We will see you next week on the free feed. Bye-bye.